Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck at the state capitol in Cheyenne. Coal producers in the U.S. are looking to markets abroad to make up for decreasing demand at home. But a recent investigation by Thomson Reuters News Service suggests that there might be royalty underpayments on those shipments. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhuroff reports that royalty question is still unresolved.
In 2012, the United States set an all-time record in coal exports, sending more than 124 million tons of coal overseas. That superlative reflects what has become unofficial policy for coal producers in the shrinking U.S. market. If the market is slowing here, perhaps Asia will be the solution. There's a problem, though. On coal mined from federal lands, which in Wyoming is about 80% of total coal produced, companies pay 12.5% royalty to the federal government, which is then shared with the state. But 12.5% of what?
If the coal's being sold at $10 a ton, for example, you'd pay your 12.5% royalty on that $10 a ton. If, though, the coal is subsequently being exported and sold to China for $90 a ton, then the government is not collecting a royalty on that higher value.
That's Mark Squalacci, director of the Natural Resources Law Center at University of Colorado Law School. Basically, no one really thought the U.S. would be exporting raw natural resources, and current laws on coal valuation reflect that.
The rules are, I think it's fair to say, not as clear as they might be.
Some coal producers might be latching on to the ambiguity to make higher profits and return less money to the government and taxpayers. Instead of selling to an independent party through an arm's-length contract and just calculating royalties using the sale price, which is pretty straightforward, they're selling to an affiliated middleman who resells it to someone in, for example, China, at a higher price. The parent company pockets profits from both sales, but the U.S. government from just one. The process for calculating royalties in an indirect sale, the one that's not as clear as it might be, is supposed to come up with a number comparable to an independent sale. In a letter, Wyoming-based Cloud Peak Energy said they calculate indirect sales by using comparable direct sales from the same mine. But they added,
third parties providing logistical services for coal are not subject to any extended royalty consideration, and there are no provisions in the current rules for such an extension of royalties to non-arm's-length entities.
Most of their sales are domestic, so are they primarily looking at third-party domestic sales from the same mine to help estimate value for coal being sold abroad through middlemen? If so, they're not taking into account the fact that the coal's final destination values it totally differently. Like Squalacci, the Colorado law professor, said, a ton of Wyoming coal in the U.S. is worth about $10, and in China, it can be 10 times that. In other words, not exactly comparable. In 2011, Cloud Peak exported less than 5% of its coal overseas, but that accounted for almost 20% of its total revenue. Squalacci says it's important to remember that these minerals belong to U.S. citizens.
The government is supposed to get fair market value for the coal. The problem that I've always had is with the way that the government determines fair market value, looking at local prices for coal when the coal is actually being sold on a global market.
And Squalacci adds that while the way you calculate the coal's worth for affiliate sales might be confusing, the rules are quite clear in their intentions.
What they essentially say is, look, in deciding what the value of the coal is, you have to look at what the coal would have been sold at, what the gross proceeds from the sale would have been if there had been an arm's length contract. That's what the rules say.
In its handbook, the Office of Natural Resource Revenue says the overriding principle for valuing coal is, quote, under any selling arrangement, the minimum value on which royalty is based is the gross proceeds accruing to the seller or his affiliate. Coal exports out of Wyoming are currently small, about 1% of total production. Almost all sales are audited. Here's director of the Wyoming Department of Audit, Jeff Vogel.
Our audit coverage is about 100%. There's just a small portion that isn't audited of the coal industry. And of that amount, we find, based off our audits, that the industry is compliant about 99.5%. So there is no issue as far as the royalty payments being made to the federal government here in Wyoming.
Governor Matt Mead's policy advisor, Sean Reese, says that's notable.
I don't think that there is any sort of nefarious activity on the part of the coal companies. They're acting in good faith. They're providing their returns. It's being audited. I think the question is whether the rules have adequate mechanisms to value those non-arm length agreements.
In other words, it's not the companies that are bad, it's the rules. The Office of Natural Resource Revenue is already in the process of reevaluating these rules. When it solicited comments in 2011, the Wyoming Department of Audit responded that the benchmarks used for valuation of indirect sales were not workable. Industry, for the most part, disagreed. In Cloud Peak's letter, CEO Colin Marshall says the accusations of underpayment are part of the war on coal that the current administration has consistently been accused of. The Department of the Interior, for its part, has acted quickly. After a letter inquiring about potential underpayments from Senator Wyden of Oregon and Murkowski of Alaska, the agency set up a task force and action plan to investigate whether there has indeed been any wrongdoing. Wyoming's Department of Audit is on the task force. Here's Director Vogel.
It's a very well thought out, comprehensive plan and very constructive plan from our point of view. It's the nature of the auditing business to look back at what's been done, what's been recorded. In this case, we're going to be looking at, did we follow governmental auditing standards when we looked at these coal sales?
The problem, though, is that the U.S. Department of Interior has not released its own official reading of the regulations. The rules are still open to debate, so it's doubtful Vogel and his auditing team will come up with anything different than before. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
Frequently during the legislative session, you'll hear lawmakers refer to Wyoming's Permanent Mineral Trust Fund. The fund was established in 1974 by then-Governor Stan Hathaway, and it's funded by a portion of severance taxes, or taxes paid by the energy industry, and occasional money deposited by the legislature. Income from the fund can be used to pay for government. It has a market value of roughly $5.6 billion, and it's viewed as a key part of Wyoming's funding future. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Treasurer Mark Gordon says the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, or the PMTF as the cool kids call it, accounts for the second most significant source of revenue for the state behind severance taxes.
What's become clear to me in the last several years, you sort of have moved past the notion of this is a good savings plan for the state to this is a significant revenue generator for the state to this has a responsibility for the state's future.
House Majority Floor Leader Kermit Brown says legislators spend about $130 million of income from the fund. He says the PMTF is what makes it possible for the state to manage without an income tax.
Take that $130 million and divide it by the number of people who are working in the state, and that would be the amount of the state income tax. And I'll tell you, it would be a substantial number that our citizens would have to pay to have the goods and services and benefits that we have right now without the income stream from that Permanent Mineral Trust Fund.
The way the fund grows, of course, is by putting money into it. Senate Appropriations Chairman Eli Bebout says lawmakers need to put even more money into the fund.
You know, in the tough times we had in the 90s, that accounted for about 25% of our revenues for the general fund. That has gone down to as low as 15% in the last 4 or 5 years. We need to get that back up to 25%.
Lawmakers have been doing that by dropping a few million dollars here and there into the fund, even in years when state agencies are facing budget cuts. Senator Cale Case stresses the reason you want to do that is because the fund may become critical in the future if revenue from the energy industry drops.
How do we have future revenues in minerals? Well, you keep supporting your permanent funds as long as you can. So when that crossover point occurs where current revenues are less than current needs, you can fall back on the earnings of the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund.
But when budgets are tight, some say the legislature should put less money into the fund. For instance, Governor Mead proposed taking some of the money that was to go into the PMTF and put it into a legislative reserve account where the money could be used more easily. Senator Stan Cooper wanted to use some of that money for highways. Floor Leader Kermit Brown says that type of conversation always picks up when budgets are tight.
They see a need, and they say there's a need there, and there's all this money. And I can't reconcile having all this money coexist with the needs. Why aren't the needs being addressed with that kind of money? And it takes a longer view of things, I think, to understand and put those two opposing views in perspective.
Treasurer Mark Gordon says that long view is important.
If we are to sort of pull monies out of it and think that we have a rainy day, that will compromise our long-term future.
But while the PMTF has generated some significant revenue in recent years, lawmakers have been inclined to save a lot of that money for a rainy day instead of spending it. But House Minority Floor Leader Mary Throne says that's the wrong approach. There is no way, she says, that the state should be considering budget cuts when the PMTF is generating millions of dollars. She argues that revenues from the fund should be used.
You can't say we have to build up the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund so it generates revenue. And then once it generates revenue, oh, we can't use the revenue from the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund.
Throne's concern is that the legislature is putting a lot of PMTF revenue into the legislative savings accounts instead of using it for necessary projects and things such as state employee raises. Senate Appropriations Chairman Eli Bebout says setting aside the revenue from the PMTF is part of the package as lawmakers plan for a future where energy revenues could be a lot less. He says they're being proactive with an eye to the future. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck in Cheyenne.
When we come back, we'll hear what the Wyoming Congressional delegation thought of President Obama's State of the Union address. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck in Cheyenne. President Obama laid out a sweeping agenda in his State of the Union address that would have a big impact on Wyoming if enacted. Matt Laszlo caught up with Wyoming lawmakers in Washington and reports on their reactions to the controversial plan.
State of the Union addresses are kind of like that list you wrote to Santa as a youngster. You knew you weren't going to get everything on it, but it never hurt to ask. The same is true with President Obama's speech on Tuesday. He's asking for an increase in the minimum wage, preschool for all, overhauling the U.S. immigration system, and a host of other items. To get any of that passed, the president knows he'll need help from Republicans like those in the Wyoming delegation.
The American people don't expect government to solve every problem. They don't expect those of us in this chamber to agree on every issue. But they do expect us to put the nation's interests before party.
Wyoming Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis says she enjoyed attending the president's annual address.
As speeches go, it was a good speech with President Obama's classic delivery, which it's fun to listen to.
Lummis supports the president's plan to end the Afghanistan war next year. But beyond that, she says it was quite an audacious wish list.
It was la-la land.
Lummis says on the surface she likes some of the president's ideas, such as his call for setting up new technological and energy hubs to help spur U.S. manufacturing.
So when he talks about new technologies, I get excited, especially as the chairman of the Energy Subcommittee on the Science and Technology and Space Committee. That makes me very excited.
But Lummis says the devil is in the details.
But I fear that the type of technology he's talking about is government-subsidized wind and solar.
Lummis points to Solyndra, a solar company that was propped up with $500 million in government loans that went bankrupt.
That is not what we should be doing. We should make sure that we're using technologies that are ready for prime time and that make energy affordable as well as abundant.
Besides energy, the president also called on Congress to pass his Jobs Act. It includes funding for transportation, first responders, and educators in Wyoming. And the president says he wants to pay for it with modest reforms to Medicare and closing tax loopholes.
Nothing I'm proposing tonight should increase our deficit by a single dime. It is not a bigger government we need, but a smarter government that sets priorities and invests in broad-based growth.
Wyoming Senator John Barrasso brushes aside the president's claim that his proposal is deficit neutral.
Well, it was a laundry list of additional ways that the president wants to spend money, money that we don't have.
Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal says the nation needs investments in areas like jobs training in order for the economy to roar back to what it once was.
Central to this speech, which made the economy the centerpiece, was the idea of bringing back manufacturing. Manufacturing and Make It in America are really what is central to our economic recovery and growing jobs and growing the middle class. And that's why this speech was so important in evoking that new spirit.
But Barrasso says the president and his party aren't taking the nation's $16 trillion debt seriously.
Well, I think the American people aren't going to be fooled a second time. He said, with the health care law, it wouldn't add a single dime to the deficit. And we know that it's way much more expensive than anything that was told. And I think the same thing's happening here.
Barrasso says he's now waiting to read the fine print from the president.
I'm still interested in seeing his budget. How much are each of these things going to cost, and how does he expect to pay for it? The deadline for submitting the budget has passed, and he hasn't done it yet.
Before the president can move on to his jobs agenda, he'll have to work with Republicans on a fiscal deal, or else billions of dollars will be indiscriminately slashed from the budget in March. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Last summer, the Cheyenne Police Department launched the Homeless Empowerment Action Team, or HEAT. Police officers and the director of Cheyenne's homeless shelter, the Comia House, went around town and talked with homeless people.
They made sure homeless individuals knew the rules regarding trespassing, panhandling, and public intoxication, and warned them of the penalties for breaking those laws. They also told homeless individuals about services available to them. The goal was to help the homeless get back on their feet and make them law-abiding citizens.
The HEAT program wrapped up in November, and the police department recently released a report about it. We're joined now by Officer Dan Long and Robin Zimmer, the director of the homeless shelter. Long says the program went well.
After we started this HEAT program, we saw a 115% decrease in public intoxication citations for transient individuals.
But I understand that the public intoxication did increase again later.
Yes, then that was for the month of October. In November, you saw that increase of public intoxication. And that could be attributed to the recidivism rate, where we have these multiple offenders that were issued the citations, and the sentence or the punishment for that citation was not any different than prior.
And Robin, I see you wanting to jump in here.
We have always seen an increase in relapse during November and December because of the holidays. And so we weren't at all surprised to see numbers increase in November, just outside of the HEAT program. We always pay attention when it comes close to holidays because those are major triggers for people that are struggling with chemical addictions.
Now, Officer Long, you mentioned recidivism, and obviously one of the goals here was to reduce the recidivism rate. Having people in jail multiple times was costing the city a lot of money. What was the effect on the recidivism rate?
It did decrease. And in the months prior to the implementation of the HEAT program, taxpayers were paying almost $63,000 for jail costs for transients. And it was continuing to increase. Once we started the HEAT program, you saw that increase stop and it started to decrease.
Robin, I wanted to turn to you for a little bit. Obviously, when the team went out to talk with homeless individuals, you basically did two things. One, you made sure that people knew what the laws were and what the penalties would be for breaking them. But also, you wanted to make sure that people knew about the resources that are available to them, that they knew about the Comia shelter, things like that. But from what I understand, most of the people that you contacted actually didn't want to take part in those social services and chose to stay out on the street. Why might that be?
The biggest reason, and like the study has shown, is because alcohol is a driving force. We have a no-tolerance policy at the shelter, as do most shelters. And so for someone who is really struggling with addiction, they're not going to be able to stay sober. And some of them don't want to because it's just harder. It's a lot harder to get sober than it is to drink. And so for them to, we say to them, well, if you come to the shelter, if you stop drinking and come to the shelter, we'll help you. That's not an option for them.
So what can be done for people like this, for people who are either addicted to alcohol or drugs, or for some other reason have some barrier that they can't really take advantage of the services that are available? What more can be done for that segment of the population?
Well, ever since probably in the early 90s, there's been a change in attitude towards serving the homeless. And prior to that, we were all taught that we dangle this carrot in front of our clients and say, if you do this, then we will provide this. And they've all failed. They relapse. They continually go back to the behaviors because it doesn't work that way. So now the new attitude is you give them housing regardless of anything else. There's no catch. There's no you're just not bribing them in any way. You give them housing. That's it. Once you take away the chaos of being homeless, you take away the fear of, you know, are my clothes going to be here in the morning? Is someone going to steal my stuff? Am I going to be able to sleep here again tomorrow? How will I eat? You take away that fear and you take away all that chaos, and the individual on their own identifies, you know, ways that they start to think of plans for themselves. I don't really need to drink anymore because all of these things are gone. Like we've said before, it is a self-medicating type of a thing. And so housing is really the number one focus now, is how do we find shelter for these individuals who are on the street? The rest of it will follow, but the shelter is our number one focus.
So are there plans for opening a wet shelter in Cheyenne?
It's in the discussion stage. We're doing the planning, the research. You can't just jump into something like that overnight. It really does take a lot of planning, a lot of coordination, a lot of cooperation, and buy-in by the community. So it's just something that we are definitely researching.
Now, you worked at a wet shelter at one point,
yes.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
What was the result there? I mean, when people came in, did they actually, if alcoholics came in, let's say, did they actually end up stopping drinking and find jobs and sort of turn their lives around?
You know, it wasn't open long enough to see that much of a result, but in the 6 months that this particular shelter operated, we saw a major decline in alcohol consumption. We saw some people go to treatment, and it wasn't by any demands that we made. The individuals chose on their own to use less and less. We set a top blood alcohol level, but that was more for safety reasons. If you blew, and it was high, a 0.275, which would be deadly for the, you know, the average human being, but if you were higher than that, we took you to the hospital because then you were in severe danger. Anything below that, you could stay. By the end of the 6 months, the average blood alcohol was below the legal limit.
One of the things that you talk about in the report that you guys put together after the fact was that you learned a lot about the homeless population. I'm curious for either of you whether you'd talk a little bit about what sorts of things you learned that you sort of hadn't known before.
I don't know if it was so much that we hadn't known, but that we just kind of put in the back of our minds, or maybe forgot, trust. It takes a lot for someone who's been on the street or who is mentally ill or struggling from addiction to walk into a business, into a bunch of strangers and say, help me. A lot of folks need you to come to them and say, I want to help you. It's just human nature that we don't ask for help, but if someone offers, we're more likely to accept it. And so it helped us come in contact with the people that, for whatever reason, were unable to walk through those doors and ask for help. And it helped, I think, with the trust, with their pride, because they felt like someone was kind of prompting them to do it. So they were a little bit more receptive. We did have some people that came in and got help. They didn't stick around for very long. Again, it was the alcohol that was kind of the driving force taking them in the other direction. But we were really pleased with just, you know, the conversations that got started. So it was really positive in that regard.
Why did you decide not to continue the program?
Well, I mean, we're looking at this as a pilot program to actually implement the program and then taking a step back and actually looking at the results, actually analyzing the data and deciding where to go from here. A couple different ideas, like Robin said, is all in the discussion stage. One possible maybe transformation of the HEAT program would be the DART team, the Downtown Area Alcohol Risk Reduction Team, where we're actually focusing on the alcohol, which is found to be the driving factor.
Okay, well, Robin Zimmer and Dan Long, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Robin Zimmer is director of the Comia Homeless Shelter, and Dan Long is with the Cheyenne Police Department. We were speaking with them about the Homeless Empowerment Action Team.
When we come back, we'll have the latest story in our occasional series, Upstarts. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck in Cheyenne.
And I'm Willow Belden. The Natural Resources Conservation Service is finishing up surveying the soil in Wyoming. They've been working on the project for decades, and they've completed surveys in most of the counties in the state. We're joined now by James Baugherd, the acting state soil scientist. He says the survey is part of a national effort to inventory or map out all the soils in the U.S.
Generally, what our soil scientists do is they will go out on the lands and they will dig a hole, generally down to 200 centimeters. And what they're looking at is they're looking at the composition of the soil as it progresses downward. And if you ever have a chance to see a soil pit, you will see various layers of soil formation. We call them horizons, but they're layers. And so what they do is they look at each of those horizons, and they're looking at various characteristics of each horizon. They're looking at the percent of sand, silt, and clay, the three particle sizes that we recognize, and the combination of those will give us what we call the texture, which could be something like sandy loam, clay, regular loam, silt loams. So they look at the texture. They'll look at pH. We want to know the pH of the soil. They will look at structure, which is basically like dirt clots, and how the soil, when you dig into the soil, you'll notice it falls out in chunks, and how those chunks are shaped and everything. They provide a conduit for water to enter into the soil. And so it becomes very important to know the soil structure. Some of the other things, we'll look at concentrations, calcium carbonate, things that may influence plant growth and vegetation, the health of vegetation, or which kind of vegetation would exist.
And so then you'll come up with a map of the soil for the entire state, essentially, so that somebody could look and say, for any given spot, this is what the soil looks like there.
That's correct.
Now, why is it so important to know the makeup of the soil and the texture of the soil and all these different attributes?
Well, for a lot of reasons. Let me preface a little bit. When Soil Survey first started out, it was primarily geared towards agriculture. So a lot of what was looked at, and still is looking at how the soil will influence vegetation and how the properties, both physical and chemical, of the soil will influence the vegetation. However, as we've progressed now, we're seeing a lot more interest in other areas as well. Engineering properties, is the soil suitable for roadbed or putting in dams or wells, things like that. People want to know the soils, building foundations. If people are building a house or putting in a building, they want to know what kind of soil is underneath there for stability. It's important to know the physical properties like sand, silt, and clay, the texture. That helps to understand how much water is going to enter into the soil, how fast it'll enter into the soil, how long it will stay in the soil and be available for the plants to use. It's also important to know for erosion control, and also from the NRCS's perspective, use that as a tool to develop conservation plans so that we can minimize soil loss to wind erosion and water erosion.
And then I'm guessing that farmers and ranchers could use this to figure out what crops to grow and things like that.
Absolutely. They definitely use that in which crops to plant, where to plant, what to do. It can even help them with fertilizer applications, things like that. So it's pretty broad spectrum on how it's used.
Obviously, this is a project that you guys have been working on for quite a while. What's the timeline moving forward? When will the surveys be completed? When will we have a complete baseline map for all of Wyoming?
And there's the million-dollar question right there. It's a little bit of a moving target. Conservatively, I would say we still have probably 5 to 10 years worth of work to be done. It's a massive undertaking.
James, thanks so much.
You bet, Willow.
The Wyoming Department of Health is encouraging Wyoming residents to test the concentration of radon in their homes this winter because it's the time of year that houses are not well ventilated, and the cancer-causing gas is more likely to rise up to living areas. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that radon kills about 20,000 people per year. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez spoke with Dr. Wallace Akerley, Director of Thoracic Oncology at the Huntsman Cancer Institute in Utah. She started by asking him exactly what radon is.
Radon is a radioactive product that's found pretty much ubiquitously across the country. It's odorless, it's colorless. Radon products live in the earth, and the unique parts about radon are that it's a gas, and it gives off radiation, but it only gives off radiation a couple of millimeters. We have lived in a world where radiation exists. We get solar, sun radiation, and our body, our skin, has been pretty good at dealing with that through evolution. On the other hand, our lungs, where we bring radon into our lungs and bathe them in high radon concentrations, is a bad thing. Radiation sitting on our lungs or epithelia triggers cancer.
So tell me about the cancer cases that you've observed or treated that are associated with radon.
Radon essentially is really just one cancer. It is totally about lung cancer. And it's one of those cancers that tends to get missed. You can talk to the janitor or talk to anybody, and they'll say, well, you know, lung cancer and cigarettes go together. And that's the assumption right off the bat. And most of the time, that's the case. Cigarettes is still the bad actor. However, about 15% of lung cancer is not related to cigarettes. And the question is, well, what is it related to? The state of Utah is kind of unique. You know, we have the lowest smoking rates in the country due to religious reasons. The LDS faith sort of forbids smoking. Consequently, we have the lowest rates in the country, and the people in Utah live a relatively healthy lifestyle. But yet I still have these patients who come in to see me, young women, young men who've never smoked in their life, who kind of notice that while I'm mountain biking, I'm becoming a little more short of breath than I used to be, or more catastrophic, I've broken a bone or I've coughed blood. And they come in and find out, well, geez, I have lung cancer. And it's terrible to them as far as they're concerned. They've done everything right, and they still end up with lung cancer that they think is only a smoker's disease.
But what can people do to protect themselves? I mean, if the radon is just sort of there, what is there to do?
It's actually very simple. If you know it's there, you got to do something about it. And the biggest question then is to measure it. You have to know that it's there. So it's a few steps. First is to get the message out to say that radon exists, but you can't see it, you can't smell it. And then the second step is if you know that it exists, you ought to do something about it. And something you should do is to get a radon test. There are many different tests. You can have professionals do it, but you can do it yourself just as easily. You basically take a little charcoal canister, you place it in the basement of your house, and it will measure radon. After 24 or 48 hours, depending on the test kit, you close it up, you send it to a lab, and you decide if your house has radon.
Why is it important to test your house?
So a house is a perfect radon collecting device. I mentioned that radon comes from the earth, and it probably comes through the earth evenly. However, certain things will draw more air in, and so we build these houses and we heat our houses. So as heat rises, it kind of forms a bit of a suction in the house. And we always get some air that comes up from below the ground, but because our house is now having a bit of a sucking action, it sucks up the radon that would come up through the house that I would be exposed to if I was outdoors, but it actually brings up radon from the periphery. And then secondly, we've gone out of our way to create these energy-efficient houses. So we're preventing all of the leaks so that we actually collect gases that leak into our house, and that's the radon issue. The house is a device that sucks more air in than it should, and the radon comes up through the ground. Our basements would have the highest levels, and then the air diffuses, and as you move up, there's less and less radon throughout the house.
Okay, but let's say I find that there is radon coming up into my house. What can I do about that?
Oh, it's actually a relatively easy fix. Sometimes to fix radon, it takes nothing more than sealing around the pipes that come up through the basement or sealing big cracks in the floor. More commonly, you can put in a mitigation device. So basically, they can put a pipe that goes through the floor of your basement out to the roof. This will create a bit of a suction there. And instead of the air coming into your house that has radon in it, it's actually passed through the heated pipe that passes through the roof of your house, and it eliminates radon from coming in. Sometimes the fix is simple. It can be a few dollars. Sometimes it can be as expensive as a couple of $1,000s. But it's a relatively easy fix, but you never know about it unless you actually measure it.
Dr. Akerle, thank you for talking with me.
Thank you.
Dr. Wallace Akerle is the director of thoracic oncology at the Huntsman Cancer Center in Utah.
In our occasional series, Upstarts, we profile Wyoming entrepreneurs. There's no shortage of self-starters in the state, many of whom build, grow, or make things. But until recently, tech startups were almost unheard of in the cowboy state. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez visited with Jason Kinsler, who founded the Pitch Engine software platform in his native lander and authored the book The New American Startup. She filed this report.
Like many successful entrepreneurs, Jason Kinsler saw a need and came up with a marketable solution. In his case, the problem was marketing in the age of social media. Kinsler says companies were using antiquated tools like Word documents and email to update media outlets and potential customers about what they were up to, but it was cumbersome.
And so I came up with this idea to package it all together and share it as a link.
In other words, each pitch a company sends out is a promotional package that can include photos, videos, relevant links, and it can be easily shared on social media sites.
We've evolved into this publishing platform, not unlike what Microsoft did in publishing for small businesses back in the 90s. You know, all of a sudden businesses could make their own flyers or, create a poster. We're sort of doing that for the web and mobile, and it's caught on.
The Pitch Engine office is certainly cool-looking enough to rival any Silicon Valley headquarters. The bright storefront on Landers Main Street has a hip, minimalist design with bright furniture, exposed wood beams, and shag carpet. The cubicles have sliding stable doors. Wearing a T-shirt, work pants, and a 5 o'clock shadow, Kinsler fits in well among the laid-back staff. It's his kind of workplace.
I'm a Wyoming kid. I was born in Lander and grew up in Wyoming. And for me, it was about trying to figure out how to stay here, not trying to figure out how to get out.
Kinsler started out in journalism as a news anchor in Billings before transitioning into a public relations job in Riverton.
As a 20-something PR guy at the time, I was online doing things with social media sites like MySpace at the time or Facebook, and I could do all this cool stuff, but as a business, as a professional, I couldn't do it. And so I came up with this idea to build Pitch Engine.
Kinsler started working on Pitch Engine on nights and weekends in 2008 and outsourced a web developer. He made sure the company could pay for itself from the start and didn't hire himself until months after the company was founded. He blogged about the challenges of brands gaining media attention and marketed Pitch Engine on social networking sites. And it worked.
I made a product for public relations pros and communicators. So when they see something cool, they share it and they talk about it. And that's sort of how it went viral.
Colorado-based Backbone Media was one of the first companies to use Pitch Engine. Backbone handles the marketing for outdoor brands, including Eddie Bauer and Smartwool, and destinations that include the Sun Valley and Telluride ski resorts. Ian Anderson is the public relations director for Backbone Media, and he says Pitch Engine has become invaluable for distributing press releases.
The traditional press release was essentially just a Word document, pretty
uninspiring and not dynamic or interactive in any way.
For instance, Backbone recently released a pitch about the GoPro camera company signing on as a sponsor for the Summer Mountain Games in Vail.
What Pitch Engine allowed us to do was embed a video from GoPro with footage from the event straight into the release, as well as links to the destination. We can talk about the competitions, the concerts, etc. And then we added photos, and then it has all the shareable options, so it can be easily tweeted, posted to Facebook, added to Instagram, etc.
But Pitch Engine offers a range of costs and services which help smaller businesses to market their brands. Paula McCormick handles marketing for the Wind River Visitors Council in Lander. McCormick says using Pitch Engine makes it easier to compete for the attention of tourists, but the platform also allows her to improve the Wind River Visitors Council's visibility on search engines and to track the exposure of each pitch.
Well, I certainly think that it helps level the playing field for those of us who are maybe in remote areas or certainly have smaller budgets. And when we can get our information out and get that increased exposure, I do think it helps level the playing field.
Now more than 45,000 companies use Pitch Engine to market their brands. Kinsler has already turned down a $9 million acquisition offer for the company. Even from Tiny Lander, Pitch Engine is a success. But the challenges of running his tech business in Wyoming haven't gone away. They've just changed over time.
When we're first starting out, we find that, you know, there's not a lot of legal support for an internet startup. You go to a bank and they don't understand that you don't have these assets that they can count. It's hard to get your arms around in Wyoming because we're just not used to that.
But Kinsler says the state is trying. He has Governor Matt Mead's ear when it comes to growing Wyoming's tech industry, a major priority for the administration.
As we grow, obviously, finding employees is a difficult thing. We've managed to bring in employees from Chicago and Texas and places like that, and we're up to 12 employees now, and that's pretty exciting, but it is difficult.
Kinsler says the people he hires don't necessarily come ready with the skills. Still, he has plans to expand the business in the state, and he says Pitch Engine might open a satellite office elsewhere someday. But he thinks small tech startups will continue to pop up in places far from Silicon Valley. Kinsler says technology has made it so location is no longer important, but Lander suits him just fine. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
When we come back, we'll have a conversation with Muffy Mead Farrow about her new book. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck at the state capitol in Cheyenne. The Hanson Mead family has been an important part of Wyoming history. Not only are they well-known ranchers in Teton County, but they have yielded two governors and even a writer. Muffy Mead Farrow has written a memoir of growing up in that family, and it's called Its Head Came Off by Accident. Much of the book focuses on her view of ranch life and of her mother, Mary Mead.
You know, most people who read the book come away thinking that I had sort of an interesting relationship with my mother, which I did. It was a relationship of great admiration, but it was also one, you know, I wasn't the most confident person growing up. I think my brothers, Brad and Matt, probably had a lot more confidence as to their role on the ranch, the cattle ranch that we all grew up on. I never felt like I was making the contribution that I should have. And frankly, I couldn't wait to get off the ranch and get to the big city where I could do a totally different kind of job. And that's what I ended up doing. I went into advertising, working in advertising agencies in Salt Lake City and in New York City. And it really wasn't until my mother died, and this is where I start the book, essentially, that it hit me how much I had loved that childhood growing up on the ranch, how much I owed my ancestors, including my mother and father, my grandparents and my great-grandparents, and what I would give to have that kind of a life back, not just for myself, but for my own children. And so it was that total change in perspective, that gratitude, that appreciation, that understanding that for, I think, so many people, comes along belatedly. You know, I think people will relate to that, that a lot of times, even if you've had a fabulous childhood, you don't appreciate it. You don't appreciate it until you get a little bit older. And for me, like I said, the departure quite suddenly of my mother was, a shock to the system, absolutely. But it also changed my perspective so much about what I had had growing up.
Tell us about Mary Mead.
Well, she was such a Wyomingite. She really thought that Wyoming was the greatest state in the nation. You know, she never apologized about Wyoming. She always felt that since we're in Wyoming, yes, we should have this and we should have this and we should have that because we're in the greatest state. And in fact, I grew up with a little bit of disdain for the state just to our west, Idaho, because Jackson is fairly close to the state line. And now, in fact, my husband and I have ended up with a little piece of property over there where we live in the summer, and our western fence is the state line, and we are a little bit sensitive about that, and we have a big old Wyoming flag on our place because we really didn't think that growing up, didn't think that Idaho was a very good state.
When we talk about your mom and your relationship, the two of you, I almost get this sense at times you're intimidated by her. Were you?
Oh, absolutely. I did not ever think that I could fill her shoes. I mean, she was an immensely capable woman. Now, whether or not she was as confident as I thought, I don't know. You know, I don't know if she had her insecurities like all the rest of us. I suppose that she probably did, but that's not what I thought at the time. I really thought that she was somebody who did everything well, and I was somebody who did not do everything well.
Mafi Mead-Farrell visiting with us. It's Head Came Off by Accident, a memoir she has written about her family and her relationship with her mother. Running for office, when your mom decided to run for governor, that seemed to be a big moment in your relationship.
Well, I was amazed that she was willing to take that on, in addition to everything else that she had on her plate. You know, and at the time we had a popular governor, Governor Sullivan, and so it wasn't something that was going to be easy. You know, it's not easy to defeat a popular incumbent governor. But that is not how she made her decision. She really believed that she had some ideas about how to run the state that would benefit the state. And that is why she ran for office. And I admired her more than ever when she did that because, you know, campaigning in Wyoming is not very easy. The voters are extremely independent-minded, as you know, and it's not like you can just go to the TV station and buy a whole bunch of airtime and, you know, reduce your campaign to a certain number of sound bites. You cannot do that. You have to drive from one small town to another, from one high school gymnasium to another, trailer parks, libraries, neighborhoods, and that's how you get elected. So the work that's ahead of you when you decide to run for statewide office is not insignificant. Anything that just increased my admiration for her, and it was a tough loss, you know, and I saw her absorb that. And it wasn't long before she filed to run for office again, and I think it was the school board in Jackson. So she didn't stop her, you know, from wanting to implement her ideas and wanting to be involved in public policy.
She gave a lot of great advice throughout this book that you tell us about. Is it don't ever have chickens? That was the one maybe that struck me the most.
Well, now, as I said, we have a place on the other side of the Tetons in Alta, Wyoming, where we spend the summer. And I have several times come right up against that decision to have chickens because I think I would enjoy tending to chickens and that I would like to have the fresh eggs. But my mother told me when I was quite young, don't have chickens. And that was the end of it. And I never really understood why she said don't have chickens. I was able to ask her brother, my uncle, about it later, and he said, well, we grew up with chickens, and it was your mother's and my job to clean out the chicken coop. To tell you the truth, Bob, she wasn't one to give very much in the way of advice. Maybe that's why certain specific things like that stick out in my mind.
Very funny book and a very interesting book about a very famous Wyoming family. Its Head Came Off by Accident. Mafi Mead-Farrell, a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on Open Spaces.
So enjoyed it. Thank you, Bob.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Tara Orr is our web editor. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates as well as reports from the state legislature, you can follow us on Twitter. You can find me under the name Butter Bob. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.